Hello and welcome to episode number 14 of the CAV podcast. I'm your host, Alan Jones, and thank you for tuning in. Now, it's been 2.5 years since the new Electronic Communications Code came into force to govern agreements for telecoms apparatus. There was a great deal of uncertainty as people grappled with the new legislation, but now a flurry of cases through the tribunals and county court is helping to clarify some of the issues. And Kate Russell, CAV's technical and policy advisor, is here to guide us through them. Well, Kate, perhaps it'd be useful to start if you could just set the scene for us.
Yes, thanks, Alad. As you said, the Electronic Communications Code came in more than 2.5 years ago now, in December 2017. And the code is a complete self-contained regime that governs the basis on which code operators can install telecoms apparatus onto third-party land and obviously take access to maintain it and in due course renew that agreement or terminate it, as the case may be. Now, the government's intention is that most agreements should be reached consensually between the parties, and we'd all hope that that's where we get to. But where they can't reach an agreement, there's a provision in the code for reference to either the upper tribunal, if you're in England and Wales, or Lands Tribunal for Scotland, or at the moment, the County Court in Northern Ireland. And that tribunal or court can then impose an agreement if the parties can't reach agreement themselves.
So why is there such uncertainty?
Well, the drafting of the code is really what's created this uncertainty. And there's two main areas where it's shown itself to be particularly problematic. One has been all about the money. What should operators be paying landowners for the right to use the site? But the other area has been about how to deal with renewals of agreements that already existed under the old regime and that are now coming to an end. So we've already had a lot of debate about the issue of money. So today I want to really focus on the other issue, this issue of the problem of how to renew an existing agreement. And some of the uncertainties have arisen because of the way the code deals with this. It has specific transitional provisions that set out how what it calls a subsisting agreement should be dealt with. A subsisting agreement is one that was in place under the old code. And as you can imagine, there are thousands of those across the country. In many cases, the initial contractual term that was agreed has already expired, but the occupiers, operators remain in occupation. They want to continue to use the site. And so it becomes necessary to renew that agreement. But those transitional provisions are not particularly well drafted, and we're seeing cases coming through the tribunals now as the various players involved in this all try to establish what the correct approach actually is.
So, as you say, we are seeing a lot of cases come through the tribunals, but how have people been dealing with these renewals so far?
Well, what we saw initially was the operators, to be honest, they were rather ignoring it and actually just trying to get a new code agreement by serving a notice under paragraph 20 of the code. And that was incorrect. The code is quite clear that a paragraph 20 route is only for new sites where there isn't an existing agreement. So taking a step back, if the existing agreement was a lease, which quite a lot of ground-mounted sites would be, then it already existed within an existing statutory regime. Now, not all code agreements are leases. There will be cases where an agreement genuinely is a license, and that's probably more likely for a rooftop site where there isn't exclusive occupation, for example, rather than a ground-mounted one, because ground-mounted sites tend to be located inside secure compounds. Exclusive occupation for a term, for a consideration, it is a lease, no matter what it's called. So where an agreement was a lease, it would have had the protection of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954 in England and Wales, unless the lease had specifically been contracted out of those security of tenure provisions. So it's important to remember that parties need to take steps to bring that existing arrangement to an end before they can look at any new agreement. And for a lease protected by the 54 Act, the route for doing that is an application by either party to the county court.
And that brings us nicely to the first of the cases that you want to consider, doesn't it?
Yes. The case that confirmed that this was the right approach was the Upper Tribunal's decision in CTIL versus Ashlock and AP Wireless. Now, it's important to stress that this decision, like a number of the others that we'll look at today, is subject to appeal. So the position that we're discussing today in late September 2020 might well change depending on the outcome of that appeal, or actually indeed the outcome of some of the other appeals that are to be considered. So it's important that people understand that position. But where we are right now with this case, by the time it reached the tribunal, CTIL was the tenant and AP Wireless was the immediate landlord of this rooftop site in Birmingham. The original lease, which was protected by Part 2 of the 1954 Act, had expired in 2012, but neither party had taken any steps to do anything about it. The tenant had the protection of both the 54 Act and the Code, so the landlord couldn't easily have terminated the arrangement. Tenant continued to pay the rent, landlord continued to accept it, everything carried on. But then eventually the CTIL did take action and they sought a new code agreement and served a notice under paragraph 20. AP Wireless said they didn't have a right to do that and that they should seek to renew the existing lease under the 54 Act through the county courts. CTIL's response in the case was to argue that it actually had either option open to it and it could choose whichever it wanted, but the Upper Tribunal disagreed. The case was heard by Martin Roger, who's the deputy president of the Upper Tribunal, and he made the point in his judgment that it was intentional that the new code did not apply retrospectively to existing agreements. So that's clear from the way the code is drafted that it wasn't intended to apply retrospectively. The transitional provisions of the code are intended to provide a pathway from the old regime to the new. And what they do is they prevent part 5 of the new code, which is the part that deals with renewals, from applying to leases that were granted before the new code came into effect and which were mainly for code purposes. So that is for the provision of telecoms apparatus rather than, for example, a Vodafone shop, and which had the protection of the 54 Act. So Mr. Roger said that the correct approach was for the parties to seek a renewal of the business lease under the 54 Act through the county court. And that's a process that can be triggered by either party. A landlord can serve a notice to terminate the agreement under paragraph 26 of the 54 Act and either object or not to the renewal of the agreement, or the tenant can serve a notice under paragraph 25.
But if the landlord does not object to a new agreement, why is it that they would prefer this route, the 54 Act approach, to a new agreement under the code?
Right, well, that mostly comes down to money, Aled. The consideration, or what we would call rent, for an agreement entirely under the new code is assessed under the code's paragraph 24, which states that consideration is the open market value of the agreement, but with several disregards applying, one of which is to disregard the use of the site for telecoms purposes. It's been called the no network assumption. On the other hand, a renewal under the 54 Act is assessed on the open market value of the site, which can include its value as a telecom site. So there's a strong expectation among landlords that a renewal under the 54 Act would result in a higher rent being payable than a renewal under the provisions of the code. So if that avenue is open to them, they will take it.
So how do the operators get out of the transitional provisions and into the new code?
Right, well, the transitional provisions of the code mean that once the county court has decided the terms of that renewed lease, that agreement is effectively a stepping stone into the new code. Because it's an agreement for code purposes and it's entered into after 28th of December 2017, this stepping stone agreement itself will fall outside of the 54 Act. So when that one expires, an operator can seek renewal under paragraph 33 of the code and then the no network assumption will apply to the assessment of the rent. So there is a very clear route through the situation, and it's one that incentivizes operators actually to request a short-term agreement so that they can step over into the new code as soon as possible.
And I think we've now had the first case to use this approach, if I'm right.
Yes, exactly. In August, we had the first county court decision in a telecoms renewal case. That was Vodafone versus Hanover Capital. And it concerned a mast in a car park on a business park in Greater Manchester. In this case, the parties had reached agreement on most of the terms for the renewal, but there were three points outstanding. One was the rent, one was the length of the term, and the third related to that was the use of break clauses. So Vodafone wanted a short-term agreement so that they can step into the new code sooner. And they asked for a three-year agreement, but with a rolling six-month break clause. And they were very clear that this was about being able to move on to more favourable terms. The landlord, on the other hand, wanted a 10-year term, which is what the original agreement had been, and they were prepared to include a tenant's option to break at 5 years, provided that the tenant gave vacant possession if it was going to trigger that break clause. So the court weighed up Vodafone's desire for a commercial advantage and moving on to a better deal against the landlord's wish for some certainty and also respite from further litigation, because it recognised that for Vodafone, this is a test case that's going to apply right across its estate, whereas for the landowner, this was a significant cost against what is a pretty modest rental income from a single mast. So, you know, it wasn't really reasonable to expect the landowner to go through it all again 3 years later. So weighing up the balance of the two, the court awarded a 10-year term with a break in favour of the operator after 5 years, but not making that break conditional on giving vacant possession. So the outcome of that in practical terms is that the landlord is certain of at least 5 years under the new agreement.
And what was the conclusion on rent in that case?
Well, we're not going to go into detail on rent in this podcast because I think we need to devote another episode to that somewhat contentious topic. But in summary, the tenant argued for a rent of £1,455 per annum. The landlord was arguing for £8,000 per annum. And the judge was again Martin Rodger. This time he was sitting as a county court judge, as he's entitled to do, but being able to bring his experience of code cases to bear, which is important. And he decided that the analysis of comparable evidence put to him wasn't sufficiently detailed for him to be able to rely on the landlord's figures. So based on the evidence that was put before him, including evidence that the site was occupied by four operators and so would likely to be one that was in demand, he ruled that the rent should be £5,750 per annum.
So would you describe that as a win for the landlord?
Well, I think the landlord will probably think it's an acceptable outcome for a five-year period, yes. It's clearly not as much as they were hoping for, but it does remain to be seen whether Vodafone will appeal against the decision. There's also clearly some way to go on the analysis of comparable evidence in order to satisfy the court or the tribunal that other telecoms deals can be a useful guide as to what should be paid in any particular case. So there's more work to be done on that. And I think there are plenty more cases waiting in the wings where that will be developed over time.
And you mentioned at the start that there were thousands of these existing agreements which will need renewal. So how are the courts going to cope if they all need hearings now and then again in, say, 5 years' time?
Well, I think that's a very good question, Aled, particularly as the upper tribunal judges are hearing all these cases themselves at the moment, both in the county court and in the upper tribunal. And there are only two judges and three surveyor members to be able to manage that. I think what's happening is that those upper tribunal judges are trying to get some of the key stumbling blocks dealt with in decisions that then will give guidance to lower courts so that it should be, all being well, less adversarial going forwards once everyone understands the procedures and the ground rules, if you like, a bit better. But we've got to remember, of course, there are some appeals waiting to be heard as well.
So far, we've focused on agreements that were protected by the 1954 Act. But what about agreements that were contracted out of the security provisions? Is there any difference to how they are treated?
Yes. It's a different approach when a lease was contracted out because there's no statutory right for the tenant to renew. So you're in different territory. But unfortunately, things get much murkier at this point.
Oh, dear. Do you want to try to explain?
Well, I'll try. So the more straightforward position is where the original agreement was contracted out of the security of tenure provisions and the term expired on or after 28th of December 2017. So where that's the case, the operator can seek renewal under paragraph 33 of the code. It doesn't have to take the county court route. The new agreement will be entirely under the new code and the rent or consideration will be assessed in line with paragraph 24. So contracted out, but the term expired on or after 28th of December 2017, we do understand reasonably clearly what the position is. But where the original agreement was contracted out, but it expired before 28th of December 2017, the position is much less clear. The first thing you've got to assess or understand is what the relationship is between the parties now that there is no agreement in place. Does the operator have a tenancy at will, which would be deemed to have arisen while the parties are negotiating new terms? Or might a new periodic tenancy have arisen? And there's no hard and fast rule to determine the answer to that question. It depends on the actions of the parties and all of the circumstances, everything that's taken place since the date when that contractual tenancy expired. And this is a question that was considered by the Upper Tribunal in our next case, Arqiva versus AP Wireless, known as the Queen's Oak case, where the original lease had expired in 2016. The tribunal needs to try and establish what the parties' intentions were regarding occupation of the site after the expiry of the lease. And in this case, the judge concluded that the operator had a tenancy at will, partly because negotiations had been underway, if somewhat sporadically, for a new agreement between the parties. So the judge interpreted that and said, the parties are negotiating, there hasn't been a significant change in their stance that indicates that they've moved into a different relationship, so a tenancy at will exists between them. But there's a twist in the tale here. Judge Cook, who was the deciding judge in this case, said that because a tenancy at will is not in writing, it can't confer code powers. Code powers must be in writing. Without code powers, the operator had no rights to seek a new code agreement. And so is actually stuck in a sort of limbo. Now, the reasoning that led Judge Cook to that conclusion derives from her analysis of the Court of Appeals decision in an earlier case, CTIL versus Compton Beecham Estates. And that appeal decision is itself subject to a further appeal to the Supreme Court. Now, Arqiva are very likely to appeal the Queen's Oak decision, but they need to wait for the outcome of the Compton Beecham appeal. And just to add further confusion, the Ashlock decision that we talked about earlier is also waiting for appeal. So you can see there's going to be a fair amount of uncertainty yet until those appeals are decided. And when you're looking at a Supreme Court appeal, that could take months to have that case decided and published.
Right. So there's rather a lot to take in there. How would you summarise the position, if you can?
Well, I'll try. So at the moment, if the original lease was protected by the 1954 Act, renewal should be through the county court first. Operators are going to argue for shorter agreements. Landlords will want longer ones. There's more to be done on the analysis of comparable evidence. And of course, don't forget, there's all the other terms of the agreement that the parties need to consider as well. Site sharing arrangements, access for maintenance works, indemnity for third party liability, and lots of other factors to also agree. So it's important that people don't lose sight of the bigger picture when they're looking at all of this. Then, if the original lease was contracted out of the 1954 Act, so one of the first things you need to do if you're involved in these cases is establish, was it contracted out or not? If it was contracted out and the contractual term ended after 28th of December 2017, the date the new code came into effect, then the operator can seek renewal under paragraph 33 of the code, go straight to a new code agreement, and I'm sure we're going to have more cases trying to thrash out exactly what the appropriate consideration is in those cases. And then thirdly, if the original lease was contracted out but expired before 28th of December 2017, at the moment no one knows how to move forward, unless you can get a consensual agreement between the parties, until those appeals are settled. And of course, all of this is only directly relevant in England and Wales because of the law of business tenancies, although the code applies right across the UK.
Absolutely. So what do we know about the position for renewals in Scotland and Northern Ireland?
Well, in Northern Ireland, leases are protected by the Business Tenancies Order 1996, and there haven't been any cases decided yet in the province, but it does seem likely that a renewal of an existing agreement should follow the usual procedure for renewal of a business lease, which is done through the Northern Ireland Lands Tribunal. So that we expect that that will be the procedure, but we await for a test case to confirm. In Scotland, it's less certain because business leases there benefit from tacit relocation, where the agreement endures after the contractual term expires. And there's been a lot of discussion as to how this can fit in with the renewal of telecoms agreements, and people proposing various different outcomes that are likely, but we don't have any decided cases yet. So we're going to have to wait and see what the Lands Tribunal for Scotland makes of that, and then possibly wait for appeals to really get a final decision.
Yes, I'm sure there is a lot more to come out as the cases continue to flow. CAV members, of course, can keep up to date by heading to the What's New section of our website, and detailed briefing notes on all the cases mentioned in this podcast can be found within the members area of the website under Telecommunications Masts. Well, Kate, it's been great having you on the podcast once again, and you've really highlighted the importance of taking good advice in what is increasingly becoming a specialist area. And there we are, we've reached the end of episode number 14. If you want to keep up to date with all future episodes, or indeed catch up on previous ones, please head to our website, or you can subscribe for free on whichever platform you use. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Also, if you've got any feedback or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch by sending us an email to enquire@caav.org.uk. But that's it for today. Until the next time, on behalf of Kate Russell and myself, Ali Jones, thank you for listening, and bye for now.